Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. Adam Boileau is back in the news chair this week, and we'll be talking through all the week's security news in just a moment. And then we'll hear from this week's sponsor, BlackBerry Silence. We will be talking about US Cyber Command dropping some sweet, sweet APT28 samples on VirusTotal back in May. And we'll talk a little bit about that malware and also have a more general discussion with Silence research staffers Steve Barnes and Josh Lamos all about Cyber Command's propensity to do that sort of thing these days. But before all of that, we're going to jump right into the news now with Insomnia Security's Adam Boileau. And Adam, no one likes having their long weekends ruined. I'm imagining that is also the case in North Korea. And yet, Cyber Command did pour a little bit of a bucket of poo on the mood when people were celebrating the day of the foundation of the Republic, because Cyber Command did, in fact, publish some admittedly old North Korean, you know, state-backed malware samples to VirusTotal. I'm guessing just to sort of, just a bit of a poke in the eye, but fun stuff.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, no one seems to be saying that these samples, they uploaded like something 11 different sets of samples of malware and things to VirusTotal. No one seems to be saying that these were, you know, brand new, shiny, amazing things, and most of them were stuff that was already being tracked. But yeah, I think a little bit of a, you know, middle finger at North Korea there from Cybercom. And also, I mean, you know, they are trying to engage more, and they have been publishing other stuff to VirusTotal. And, you know, there's a bunch of work going on to, you know, engage a bit more, provide a bit more stuff. And, you know, I guess this is one's been sitting around in their collection for a while, and you know, why not use it to send a bit of message while you're at it?
Yeah, I figure that's it. I mean, there were a bunch of people on Twitter saying, "Oh, now we got to come into work on our weekend," you know, like people in America and stuff. And it's like, hey, this wasn't designed for you to come in on the weekend. This was designed for someone else to come in on the weekend. But we've also seen some, you know, old grumpy incident responder types on Twitter.
Who imagines they would exist?
And they're basically saying, let's not, you know, gush over, you know, over these things winding up on VirusTotal. It doesn't change anything. Yeah, pretty much. But they do make the point too that just because something winds up on VirusTotal doesn't necessarily mean people stop using it. And I think that is something to remember.
Yeah, I mean, we've certainly seen that, you know, actors who are less concerned with attribution and less concerned with being snapped are quite happy, you know, pottering along with, you know, their old techniques that have worked for ages and will continue to work. And, you know, they leave a big, you know, trail of IOCs in the wake behind them, then, you know, so be it. Who really cares? And I mean, even good campaigns get snapped as well. So,
yeah,
I mean, you know, every time you fire it on the wire, right, I mean, you're going to have a bad time.
Yeah, I mean, what are you going to do to DPRK? Like, sanction them?
exactly right, yeah. Best thing you can do is ruin their weekend.
That's it. Now, you alluded to it earlier, but, you know, I'm guessing we're going to see more of this because as the NSA stands up its new cybersecurity agency, its chief, Ann Neuberger, has been speaking at various events and whatnot and saying, yeah, we're gonna be trying to get more information to the people who need it in the private sector. And this, you know, this makes a lot of sense. I don't know if that just means they're going to go absolutely, you know, VirusTotal berserker, but I think there is that, it's a continuation of that change that we're seeing where these agencies are realizing they've got to engage a little bit more with the public.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen, you know, a bunch of efforts in the past to share some of the information that, you know, they and other branches of government have available to them. And often it is, you know, kind of dispensed without enough context or without enough technical specificity or not fast enough. And I think, you know, they're thinking through how this whole process does kind of need to work. And, you know, without some of the, oh, we're just going to kind of, you know, quietly proxy the information, you know, through some of the, you know, private sector companies that handle the stuff. So, you know, a bit more of an organized front. And yeah, if they could do it faster and more time effectively, and in a way that, you know, gives everybody what they need, you know, some structure in terms of the overall international picture of who's doing what, as well as all of the technical details, rather than having those things be very disjointed, which is what we've kind of seen in the past.
Now, how not to write a press release is our next is our next topic.
Apple.
This story should be dead, and yet it is not. Apple has kept it alive by issuing a statement. Now, of course, I'm talking about this watering hole attack that targeted Uyghur Muslims who are visiting websites of interest to Uyghur Muslims. Those websites were serving up iOS exploit chains, 1.0 day, I think, and a bunch of end day exploit chains. The thinking seems to be, just from the conversations that I've had with other people, that these websites were likely targeting the diaspora. So Uyghur Muslims living outside of China. And basically, yeah, anyone who visited those websites was going to get hosed this way. Now, of course, other websites have been found, you know, of similar interest to that community, have been found serving up Windows implants and Android implants and whatnot. But of course, Apple is getting the most of the attention here because, you know, this is a bit of man bites dog, right? You're not used to seeing iOS exploit chains just thrown around willy-nilly on the web where, Google Tag can get their greasy hands all over them. So, you know, it is news for a reason. But then now Apple has put out this statement that kind of does, kind of doesn't really dispute Google's version of events, but it was written, look, I just think, you know, the messaging in this statement was truly awful. I'm going to read from the statement now. It says, last week, Google published a blog about vulnerabilities that Apple fixed for iOS users in February. We've heard from customers who are concerned by some of the claims, and we want to make sure all of our customers have the facts. First, the sophisticated attack was narrowly focused, not a broad-based exploit of iPhones en masse as described. Well, Apple, that's arguable. You know, we can actually have an argument about that. And it goes on to say the attack affected fewer than a dozen websites that focus on content related to the Uyghur community. Regardless of the scale of the attack, we take the safety and security of all users extremely seriously. Now, this is rising to the 10 out of 10 borderline insulting trope scale at this point, isn't it? What did you make of this statement? Because it sort of does imply, the tone of it does sort of say, well, it's just Uyghurs.
That's unfortunately it, right? It comes across like, it doesn't really matter. Just, small group, the implication is, Muslims in a small corner of the world, not really our problem, which is,
And let me be clear too, just let me jump in there. I want to be really clear that that's not the way that people you and I know, people that you and I know within Apple, they don't think like that, right? So I want to make it very clear that we understand that the people who work on the security teams at Apple take this stuff extremely seriously. It's just a shame that this statement got put out that kind of gives a different impression.
Yeah, I mean, that's really the feeling that I got walking out of this, that we know the security people there. We know they're doing a good job, right? We know how hard they work. And they've just kind of been let down by this being too much spun by corp PR rather than, kind of staying in the security wheelhouse where people, understand that particular phrasing, for example, that we take the safety and security of users seriously is just, kind of the middle finger of, security response. Like, you may as well give Uyghurs free credit monitoring. That's kind of the level that we're at there. And that's, just didn't do Apple any favors when, they are trying to position themselves where they actually take it seriously, as opposed to just saying that in a press release,
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, look, I'm in two minds about this because we don't know, right? There's a lot we don't know about what's happened here. Because they also say in this statement that they were in the process of fixing the bugs already when they were notified, but they didn't say why. Like, they could have just been rewriting various components, right? They don't say that they detected it, but they kind of imply it. So there's a lot we don't really know here. But I will say too that, no one's really expecting Microsoft to issue statements on this, right? Or for Google to issue statements with regard to the exploitation of Android here. So I do feel we sort of have this habit of holding Apple to a higher standard, but Apple kind of put itself there, right?
Well, they are. I mean, they're trying to differentiate themselves by taking this stuff seriously. And so, of course, they're going to get called to task when they subsequently don't. And, I there's a few other bits of it that I found that I didn't really enjoy their characterization. I mean, the way that it's, about the number of websites that were serving the content as opposed to the number of users, or the fact that the bugs are viable against the entire user base, right? Not like the fact that they've been specifically targeted in this case towards, the group in interest, the group that China has a particular interest in, is kind of not relevant, right? They could have taken you or I, with those bugs, right? That's what's missing from this, it was only a few websites and only a short period of time, right? I mean, they've had a demonstrable capability against fully patched devices that affects a billion users, right? So
it would be great if Apple came out and told us that they actually detected this in the wild, because right now they've implied it without actually saying it. So we don't know if they did. We also don't know what the response looked like on the other end. So I'm going to play, just to wrap this up, I'm going to play the words of wisdom from Donald Rumsfeld right now.
As we know, there are known knowns. There are things we know we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns. The ones we don't know, we don't know.
And that's where we are.
Yep, that's a state-space diagram right there.
That's pretty much it. So let's just move on. Oh, and quickly too, I wanted to correct some comments I made last week. I mentioned some comments by an Australian politician named Andrew Hastie and said that he had compared China to Nazi Germany, and specifically in the context of talking about the treatment of Uyghur Muslims in Xinjiang. That wasn't actually correct. He did compare the sort of the rise of China to the rise of Nazi Germany, but he was talking more in terms of military buildup and other sort of more global concerns. So I've linked through to the actual op-ed that he wrote because it's, you know, it's pretty interesting. But yeah, I did make a mistake and mischaracterize his comments last week. I sort of got his comments confused with a bunch of the commentary that resulted from his comments, if that makes sense. So yes, oops, I will strive to do better. Now look, you know, we've just been talking about some bugs, you know, some sophisticated, and funnily enough too, the use of the word sophisticated really jumped out of that Apple press release as well. It's like, hey, you know, what are you going to do? They were sophisticated. from sophisticated bugs to less sophisticated bugs, we got a story here looking at, I guess you call it a vulnerability, affecting a whole bunch of Android phones, like half of them. But, you know, this is the sort of thing that as an attacker is very, very useful and the sort of thing that you're probably not likely to see affecting an iPhone.
Yeah, this is a report from some research done at a checkpoint into the over-the-air provisioning messages used by mobile carriers to kind of push out, you know, proxy settings and where your WAP server is and SMS gateways and all sorts of, you know, important stuff like that. In their research, they showed that you can deliver, you know, the binary SMS OMACP provisioning messages to a bunch of different Android mobile phones, and they're not correctly authenticated. Or in the case of Samsung phones, just not authenticated at all. And yes, the user gets a pop-up and they have to accept, you know, there's an update to the carrier settings or whatever. And then if they do so, you can, you know, kind of man in the middle of them by virtue of updating the proxy settings. Now, in some of the mobile phone brands that they've looked at, I think, you know, LG and Sony and a few of the other Android vendors, you have to send a message packed with the hardware IMSI of the phone to make them work. In the case of the Samsungs, apparently you can just send them any way you like and it, you know, gets the pop-up. And yeah, if you can social the user into clicking on them, then great. So, I mean, it's not quite as sweet as some of the other OMA bugs that we've seen with, yeah, you know, meme corruption and the XML parsers and stuff.
Yeah, that was, I know the stuff you're talking about. That was pretty good.
But yeah, so these require user interaction. But I mean, if you've ever received one of those, you know, carrier settings update messages, you have no way to validate them. You don't know what they're going to do. And you are faced with, my phone might stop working if I don't click OK. Of course, you're going to click OK. So it's a, you know, quite a useful technique. And they've got some, you know, some tooling and some examples, if, you know, that might come in handy if you're a pen tester or someone who would like to hack some phones.
I usually click no, go away about 10 times and then fine, whatever, yeah, basically look, towards the end.
That's what everybody does.
Yeah. Conscious. We got some actual Ode getting dropped too, which is Privesque on Android OS.
Yeah, this was a bug that came out of the ZDI program that had been reported to them a while ago. This is a local Privesque in, like, the video for Linux drivers in Android. Google apparently is working on a patch, but has not yet gotten around to patching it. And yeah, ZDI have exceeded their, you know, kind of disclosure windows, dropped the details of the bug on the website. So yeah, if you need some yet more Android local Privesques, then you know, check it out.
It's funny, isn't it, when you got Trend Micro dropping Ode on Google, you know, like, it's just the Zero Day initiative is these days, it's a Trend Micro joint. So there you go. Now, we've discussed this a couple of times over the last few weeks, right? These bugs that were disclosed at Black Hat in the Pulse Secure and Fortinet VPN servers. Now, you know, you and I have been talking a little bit lately about how dropping bugs publicly kind of isn't the done thing anymore because, you know, people are going to take them and do awful things with them. And yeah, like, apparently Chinese APT crews are all over these ones, which is just like, oh.
Well, I mean, you know, why wouldn't they? And I, you know, to a certain extent, that kind of mindset amongst the hacker scene of, you know, Ode dropping being cool back, and I'm absolutely, you know, guilty of doing this myself, you know, that was cool and hip and we all did it. And, you know, those bugs were getting nicked and used by nasty people for years and years before. I mean, my FireWire stuff from 2005, you know, that was in HP Gary weaponized it and sold it to the US military, you know. So this was absolutely happening in the old days. We're just a bit more
aware. And they didn't even give you a cut.
I know, it's so rude. So rude. but yeah, whereas these days it's much more apparent. You know, you drop a bug at Black Hat, neck minute, it's being used by, you know, Chinese APT crews to hacks. Who knows, right? I mean, obviously there's a lot of Fortinet boxes out there. A lot of people run them, and they're all going to get, probably all have already been owned. So you know, go roll some instant response if you have one of those.
Speaking of bugs getting dropped, Metasploit has dropped a Bluekeep module. So that's that RDP bug that was patched by Microsoft some time ago. As far as I understand it, the bug that they've published only works out of the box against Win 7. Otherwise, you've got to faff about with some offsets and whatever to get it to work against other versions of Windows. Is that correct?
I think also 2K8R2. But yeah, if you want other versions of Windows, then there's some fiddling to be done. You know, people have been making, I guess, a bit of hay about Metasploit dropping it, but I mean, there have been a bunch of other private exploits and commercially available ones, in the case of the Immunity one, kicking around for a while. And we haven't really seen it get turned into an internet-ruining worm yet, so, you know.
Well, I think the big difference with the SMB stuff that Shadow Brokers dropped is that was just out of the box, worked against everything.
Yeah, whereas this, you know, does still require a bit of fiddling. And it's a fiddly bug anyway, with all the heap grooming and, yeah, it's not the world's most straightforward, you know, IIS bug like we had in the old days, but hey, that's probably also for the best, you know.
Now, this next story, I'm kind of a bit spun out to see it going around again. CyberScoop's carrying it, but I've seen other outlets carry it as well. It's based on some research from Checkpoint where they're like, you know, speaking of those SMB bugs that Shadow Brokers dropped, there was a round of reporting that came by a few months ago that said that the Chinese APT crews had been using the same bug. But it looked like what they'd done is actually grabbed it somehow, maybe off the wire, you know, reverse engineered it, figured it out, and then they started using it. So, you know, they reverse engineered the exploit from sniffing it on the wire. And now Checkpoint's published some research that says they reverse engineered it by sniffing it off the wire, most likely, and it's doing the rounds again. Wait, is there anything new here? I mean, why is this getting attention?
I mean, I don't think it's new. The idea that you would, you know, either purposefully get boxes owned or you would take advantage of getting boxes owned to steal the bugs and steal the techniques, like, just seems like normal tradecraft.
Yeah.
We have seen in the past, you know, where people go back through, you know, archives of historical network captures and information. When you discover a new ISC, you learn new information about tooling or a particular technique to figure out, you know, who else knew about things beforehand and what they knew and when. And that kind of analysis is interesting. And so, you know, maybe they were doing some other work and this kind of came out as an interesting nugget. But yeah, it is a, you know, a story we've kind of heard before, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I mean, you can do it by sniffing off the wire, and also crash dumps are great if you configure your Windows fleets to report to your own server. I mean, but that's what they do, right, for this reason. So we got this report from Deutsche Welle, and I'm sort of surprised it hasn't made it into the mainstream security press. Is that even a thing? But anyway, haven't seen it really doing the rounds. German prosecutors are investigating FinFisher or Gamma Group over, you know, their various alleged misdeeds.
Yeah, in this case, the investigation is looking into the use of their FinSpy mobile Trojans to compromise people doing anti-government protesting in Turkey. The Germans are supposed to obtain kind of export licenses when they're shipping the stuff out of the EU, and, you know, Turkey's NATO, sure, but yeah, having a bit of a mess down there at the moment. And yeah, the Germans are rather sensitive, I think. So we're seeing this investigation, you know, kind of look into whether or not they should have sold it to the Turks, and then kind of what happens, you know, with their spyware industry from there. We'll see.
What's this got to do with Germany? Because it was always my understanding that Gamma Group were like a British outfit.
Yeah, so apparently there's some kind of like combined German-British outfit. Like, they've got some operations in Germany. I'm not sure exactly, you know, how the company structure works, but like, clearly the Germans feel it's in their jurisdiction. So, yeah, good for them.
One to keep an eye on. Twitter has disabled SMS to tweet after @Jack wound up tweeting a whole bunch of racist stuff the other week. It was reported as a simjacking, but, you know, like, you could probably have done this by spoofing SMSs the right way. So, yeah, that's pretty interesting. I guess it goes to show that if you want a security feature introduced into a popular platform, all you have to do is make it a priority of the CEO by owning them.
Well, I mean, it seems effective because they've turned off access to SMS to tweet. They say temporarily, but realistically, I think they just want this to quietly die yeah. And then they'll never turn it back on again because, you know, the whole building their platform around 140 character SMS since 10 years ago, whatever it was, it's pretty firmly in the past. So, yeah, it could probably just quietly die.
Paige Thompson has pleaded not guilty to all charges in connection with the data breach at Capital One, which is interesting. That's a bold strategy. Let's just say that. Throwing in the old not guilty plea there. So I don't know what the play is here.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure because, I mean, wasn't she like boasting about it on Slack and stuff, and they've got all the logs, and I mean, yeah, I don't know where it's going. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know where that's going either. And of course, we wouldn't want to prejudice the trial or anything like that. These are all just allegations. It is entirely possible that Paige Thompson is completely innocent of the charge. I'm just kidding. No, it is of course a possibility.
It's absolutely
so we have
possible,
to
yes.
We have to see what the defense actually looks like, right? So let's see. We've got some more ransomware attacks against schools in the US. Just more of the same here.
Yeah, we've seen a whole bunch of schools closed in Arizona because they got ransomware, which is, you know, obviously not a great look unless you're a kid that doesn't want to go to school there, which is, you know, probably most
That's a lot of kids. But, I mean, it is just, you know, it is that steady drumbeat now. And we got some additional reporting around those, the municipalities that got owned in Texas. Apparently none of them paid the ransom. That was good. I'm hearing rumors, too, that a lot of this stuff now, people are targeting MSPs, right, so that they can do bulk ownage like what happened in Texas.
Yeah, I mean, it makes a lot of sense, right? You got the bugs, then you may as well get maximum return on investment and owning everybody, you know, that uses a particular piece of software or a particular service provider at once. Just, you know, it just makes good sense.
There you go. And I got an interesting tweet here that I wanted to highlight. Chris Bing was at the Billington Summit, I guess. And we've seen a comment again from Anne Neuberger, who is the director of the new NSA Cybersecurity Agency. She had some interesting comments there. She said that ransomware represents one of the threats facing the election, and it's a notable vector of attack following attacks on cities across the US. So what we are seeing is the United States intelligence agencies are starting to link ransomware with election security. And if I was a ransomware operator, that would make me very nervous.
Yes, any excuse, right? And tying those two issues together, well, they don't kind of really need to be yet, you know, until someone's actually ransomware to actual elections. Yeah, it does kind of, you know, suggest
well,
where they're
positioning
things. Well,
you kind of want to do it before. It's sort of like OPSEC. You want to do it before you need it, right? Like, don't you
well,
think?
Exactly, yes. Yeah, it's sort of pre-parallel construction or something. I don't know.
Pre-parallel construction, that's right. Oh, now this next one, this is a very interesting story. This is a very interesting story because a judge in the United States has ruled that website scraping does not violate the CFAA and furthermore has ordered LinkedIn, apparently, has ordered LinkedIn to stop implementing technical controls preventing another company from scraping LinkedIn public profiles. Now, like you and I have both said before, you know, oh, scraping a website, that shouldn't be illegal, whatever. I don't know, man, because like these days you kind of look at some of the business models popping up around scraping and you just sort of think maybe it's good that that's kind of illegal in the US.
how we've changed in our opinions on the show. I mean, I feel like the first half, like the fact that it's public information and scraping it, you know, isn't really a computer crime. You know, it's just kind of regular being a jerk. Like that bit I'm on board with the making them turn off technical countermeasures. Like that seems a bit rude. I mean, if they want to play an arms race with someone who's scraping their stuff, then, you know, so be it, right? It doesn't really seem like that's the court's business to, you know, to go tell them not to. But yeah, you're right. I mean, there are a bunch of business models that have grown up, you know, doing, you know, skeezy things with other people's data. And, you know, I don't know that the CFAA was necessarily the right tool to hit that with, but, you know, I don't know. It's confusing.
Yeah. But look, all the lawyers, all the like cyber lawyers are all a titter over this one. So I'd suspect we're going to see a lot more discussion about that in coming weeks. Meanwhile, 51 chief executives have sent a letter to the US Congress asking for a federal data privacy law. And look, you talk to any sort of CISO in the US about the patchwork of state laws that they currently have to comply with. Like, it's no wonder they're just begging them to come up with a federal regulation because complying with everything is just turning into a compliance nightmare. That seems to be what this is about. But you've also got some cynics which are saying, you know, what they're trying to do is get a one federal regulation that they can, you know, dispatch the lobbyists to try to water down so that they wind up with something a lot weaker. I suspect the most pressing need here actually has a lot more to do with just, you know, the state-by-state variation in privacy laws causing them all sorts of headaches and legal costs.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right there. I mean, it's certainly not about, you know, consumer privacy. It's absolutely about, you know, they just want one set of laws, maybe two with GDPR to comply with because it's just so expensive.
Our lawyers are killing us, man. Yeah. You watch the law firms come and lobby against this, you know?
Such capitalist dystopian future we live in.
That's wonderful. Microsoft and the Hewlett Foundation. Well, really, I should say the Hewlett Foundation and Microsoft, because this really looks like a Hewlett Foundation kind of initiative. They're launching a non-profit organization dedicated, quote, to exposing the details of harmful cyber attacks and providing assistance to victims in an effort to highlight their costs. So this looks like some sort of state-backed attacker activity database and resource. It looks like an interesting idea. It's not super well documented at the moment. Oh, and as a disclosure, Risky Biz did actually receive a grant from the Hewlett Foundation to do some of those policy interviews. But, you know, there's some smart people there, and this looks interesting.
Yeah, this is a proposal for the Cyber Peace Institute, and it's kind of roughly being compared to the International Atomic Energy Agency, a sort of non-governmental transnational organization that provides kind of, you know, oversight and watchdog and, you know, information sharing to try and keep, you know, the norms of behavior and, you know, in the atomic world of the IAEA, obviously, you know, in line with what, you know, we would sort of like to see. And exactly what that means is, you know, is still a little bit unclear. They're talking about, you know, some, you know, database of activities trying to attribute, you know, campaigns and activity being carried out in the cyber world to try and provide some accountability and visibility, because that's one of the things this you know, industry does really lack, is visibility into what's going on. In terms of funding, right, they're talking about, what, like $5 million as the initial funding round from the Hewlett Foundation, and then a bunch of other organizations like Microsoft, you know, chipping in some as well. But, you know, they've talked about, for example, helping out with incident response and providing staff to support that. And that's a really expensive thing to do. And, you know, one of the questions, of course, I had was, you know, where we've seen private sector organizations keep tabs on nation state actors, it tends to be those, you know, organizations like, you know, Symantec and Checkpoint and CrowdStrike and FireEye, and, you know, people who are, you know, out in the field doing a bunch of the work, and they see a whole range of actors, you know, beyond just state ones, and then, you know, they're able to kind of, through that context, kind of put the pieces together. And I do wonder whether an organization that isn't out there in the trenches doing the work is ever going to have enough visibility to be effective.
I think they're going to look, it's my expectation that they'll be doing work with those people. Do you know what I mean? Like this is supposed to, I don't think they're trying to replace frontline work, but I think they're trying to centralize a lot of this stuff and draw some insights out of it. Because as you point out, right, like a lot of this is scattered across blog posts from like FireEye and, you know, Checkpoint and whatever. And having a central, like non-commercial place for that data to live, I think you'd, you know, I'd be surprised if companies like CrowdStrike, FireEye, whatever, don't actually jump on board with it.
Yeah, I mean, we'd certainly hope so. I mean, even, you know, we've seen other efforts that kind of similar. And I think like the MITRE, you know, attempts to provide standardization for naming and for things and for CVEs and that kind of, you know, we have seen this kind of, you know, non-commercial kind of shared, you know, shared services, I guess, in a way work well in other fields. So, yeah, I mean, there's absolutely room for it to work. But I do think it really is going to need buy-in, you know, from those people out in the front line, you know, doing this work.
We got a little story here on ZDNet about patch gaps in Chrome, which probably aren't a problem right now, but that's a bad habit to get into. What is happening is like things like Chrome's V8 JavaScript engine are getting fixed, but it's taking a while for those fixes to actually reach the browser release.
Yeah, I mean, this is an approach we've seen a bunch of people use in the open source world, where you sit on the bug track, as you sit on the mailing list, you catch the bugs as they get unembargoed in the upstream code base, and then you know you've got a window of time before that code base percolates into mainline products like Chrome or mainline distributions, you know, where there is the, you know, a time window to exploit there. And, you know, in this case, we did see a couple of interesting bugs that are, some researchers have been tracking that were fixed in Chrome's JavaScript engine that were, you know, meant that real Chrome was vulnerable for a while because of that delay. And, yeah, it's a, you know, you get some good bugs there, even if they are, you know, limited in their shelf life.
Would you think that this is something that Google would probably want to get on top of? Because it's just my feeling that, you know, a browser that's that critical, that's got that sort of install base, like you probably want to minimize those windows.
Yeah, I mean, obviously open source projects do have approaches to handle, you know, embargoed security information and to try and feed it back. I mean, in this case, it's hard to say without knowing, you know, I mean, Google's been pretty good at handling that with Chromium and with V8 and the other, you know, the other open source components, because they are so, you know, because so many Google employees are tied up in the process anyway. I think it kind of happened pretty naturally. But yeah, maybe the process needs a little bit more formalization given the impact of bugs in core, you know, in core Chrome.
Yeah, well, we'll see what happens there. Now, this next story, Kaspersky has launched an anti-cheat solution For esports tournaments. This is actually a really cool idea. Apparently the esports tournaments, like, you know, in the final rounds and whatever, everybody's playing on tournament supplied hardware, so it's not so much of an issue. But in qualifying rounds, apparently there may be a little bit of cheating going on there. So Kaspersky's come up with some, you know, tailored anti-cheat software that these tournaments can demand people run. That's pretty cool, right? Like, it's fun seeing someone actually develop a solution here.
Yeah, and it makes a lot of sense because, you know, the tools of writing an antivirus client has so much in common, you know, with instrumenting any other piece of software to see if it's being interfered with. So it seems like it would not have been a whole bunch of work for Kaspersky to put something together. And it's, you know, it's good high profile, you know, good visibility for them because esports is kind of, you know, a rising thing. So yeah, seems like a smart move by Kaspersky. They need a good PR, you know, win at the moment, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, they need a few things. Marissa Emerson was on the show, I think, oh God, when was that? Last year, year before, talking about game cheating stuff. It's really interesting, actually, like surprisingly interesting. That was probably, like, that's one of the most popular interviews I've ever done. At the time, too, she was working somewhere quite boring. And then I think after the Risky Biz episode went out, she wound up getting a job offer from a game company. So she's actually moved abroad to do that. And I think last I heard, she was very happy doing it. So hi, Marissa, if you're listening, hope it's going well. Mozilla is launching a VPN extension for Firefox users in the United States. And this is, you know, this is a way for Mozilla to actually make a bit of money.
Which they probably need, to be fair. But yeah, it makes sense for them to have it integrated into the browser, you know, have a, you know, they've been talking about Tor integration, for example.
Can't make money out of that.
But yeah, you're not going to make money out of that. Whereas, you know, selling a commercial VPN service with, you know, some degree of oversight about the, you know, the quality of the services, that sort of thing, seems like a smart move for them. They've also been working on other things to try and make Firefox more resilient to local network, you know, kind of local networks that are interfering with how you use the internet. We've seen them also talking about their DNS over HTTP solution that they're going to, it sounds like they want to roll it out for 100% of Firefox users eventually, but they are trialing that in the US at the moment where Firefox will make DNS queries by itself over HTTPS off to Cloudflare's resolvers so that your local ISP won't be able to get in the middle and, you know, hijack your DNS for whatever reason.
That's right. Cloudflare's DNS resolver gives you racist answers only.
There you go. Ooh. Oh, dear.
Now, let's talk about this attack that apparently affects, quote, Intel server-grade CPUs. Some Intel chips apparently are vulnerable to this side channel, man, which looks pretty super specific, right? Like, I don't think – this is one of those things that's cool research, weird side channel. Don't expect it to show up in the wild anytime soon. But this apparently affects the Intel DDIO feature. Tell us about it, Adam, because I know you love this side channel complicated stuff.
I mean, this is definitely one of these kind of, you know, pet projects of university researchers who really, really love side channels because it's one of the few places you can do computer science in security and get good results. Anyway, this is another kind of timing-based side channel across the network to try and extract information out of caches on the CPUs where they're shared across, you know, kind of security zones. In this case, through the DataDirect I/O technology, Intel's DDIO, which is basically a mechanism for very high-speed network interfaces and other peripherals to shove data straight into the CPU cache without necessarily going through RAM. So it's kind of like DMA, but more so, you know, where we've seen network cards be able to bus master directly into main memory. This is the same thing, but for on CPU cache. And so, of course, the moment you put anything into cache, then there's options for side channel kind of attacks. And that's what these researchers have put together, a mechanism for doing that, where you've got multiple network streams, you know, one of which is attacker controlled, crossing into the CPU's cache and then using the timing results to try and exfil data. And the example that they came up with is, you know, on one hand, just super contrived. And on the other hand, actually kind of cool in a way. They're demoing this by recovering keystrokes from an SSH session, from a, you know, from a machine that they haven't attacked to a server they don't control, using this kind of timing side channel across the network. And they're doing it based on the, you know, inter-key timing delay. You know, if you're typing with two hands in English on a QWERTY keyboard, then the inter-key delays are different depending on the combinations of letters you're typing, and then from that statistically recovering, which is, I mean, you know,
it's going to be easier to beat the admin over the head with a lead pipe until they give you the password, though. Like, let's be honest.
I mean, It's kind of, I mean, I don't want to say it's junk hacking because it's not. It is real and it like, okay. But it's a bit of a stretch to say that anyone's ever going to do this in the wild, I think.
Yeah.
They're also combining this with RDMA, which is the Intel tech for remote DMA, which was already a terrible idea, that other different types of high-speed networking use, typically InfiniBand interconnect. But essentially the only place where you're going to see this type of networking probably is going to be in large-scale cluster computing with very fast interconnects and very close access. And you kind of, if you're in a position to do this, you probably already won.
There's probably a whole bunch of easier ways. You just own them via their super micro BMC, right? Like,
well, exactly right. You're just going to go hit the storage or the management or the admins or like, yeah. If you're already in the supercomputer, you probably already routed it all anyway with the bad passwords, and you kind of don't need to do stunt hacking. But on the other hand, it is good quality stunt hacking. So
speaking of bad passwords, and I was just telling you this before we recorded, Darknet Diaries, the security podcast, but it's more like security stories, right? Jack Rysider posted, it's a two-part special. It runs for like, each part is like an hour and a half, but it looks at the adventures of the Xbox Underground, which is a group of Xbox hackers who between them wound up like getting access to like the Xbox developer network via developer editions of the Xbox that they found in like, I think it was like a garbage tip or something. And then like going through like cred dumps and like owning the absolute shit out of basically the entire gaming industry. I'm about halfway through it. I've listened to part one. I'm like 10 minutes into part two. It is fantastic. Go listen to it. It's really, really good. We spoke, I can't remember if this was with you or Alex, but we spoke recently on the show about the arrest of a few people involved in business email compromise scams. Apparently now the US has arrested 281 people worldwide who are accused of involvement in business email compromise scams, and they've seized nearly $3.7 million. Now, this comes hot on the heels of an announcement on the same day from the FBI that announced losses from business email compromise scams have resulted in $26 billion in losses since June 2016. So like, okay, 281, it's a good start, but you're still barely scratching the surface.
Yeah, and this they arrested 281 people and they seized something like $3.7 million worth of proceeds from this fraud, which if you divide that over 26 billion, it's quite a small percentage.
It is, yes. I mean, I'm not suggesting that they give up doing law enforcement here. I'm suggesting that this problem is probably one that law enforcement can't solve. Oh, now look, speaking of BEC and those, you know, those sort of businessy compromises, there's a story been doing the rounds the last few weeks, actually, about someone apparently using a machine learning-based like voice impersonation tool to like do a phone scam to instruct an employee to transfer some money out. Now, it has been doing the rounds, but I got to say, I am a little bit skeptical, right? Like no one has been arrested and their computer recovered with like voice-based machine learning tools on them doing deep fake audio. Like it's entirely possible someone just did an impersonation of the chief executive in this case. It is probably something we're going to see in the future, but I'm not sure that this is it. What do you think, Adam?
Well, I mean, it's certainly a believable story. I mean, whether this particular one happened as reported, I don't know. I mean, one of my colleagues has been tinkering with some of the voice generation stuff. He was using Risky Business actually as sample input. I can get him to demonstrate that perhaps. This particular story is attributed to like the insurer of the company that got scammed via this mechanism, which is a bit, you know, kind of like my dog's cat's tennis partner's second cousin told me sort of thing. So it's a bit, you know, it's a bit wishy-washy, but I mean, it is a thing that's going to happen. Like it makes sense. It's going to work. And the technology exists, so why wouldn't you do it?
If I ever ring you, anyone listening, if I ever ring you and ask you to like send me money, just keep in mind that there is a massive training set to impersonate my voice on the internet, so it's probably not me. Unless I really am broke, in which case it absolutely is me, send me all your money.
Pat didn't say any of those things. He didn't.
That's right. Fake news. What else have we got here? Oh, yeah, a power grid operator in the US had a bit of a bad time when someone out there, God knows who it was, but they were just like DOSing their firewalls. So they were like rebooting pretty regularly over a period of hours. But this is kind of a good news story because I think initially they were treating it as an intrusion and then they realized it was just someone like single packet of death DOSing their shitty enterprise grade firewalls.
I mean, it's probably just background noise, to be honest, and they were the only ones who hadn't patched. But yeah, I mean, it's I guess it's a good story. Like, they've learned to patch their firewalls perhaps this time. I mean, whether those firewalls were up to the task of, you know, securing power generation when they're single packet DOSable, another question. But, you know, it's we don't have much in the way of good news stories, so we'll take it.
Yeah, that's a good news story, I guess. Sure, let's go with it. Krebs on Security is reporting that the U.S. Secret Service is investigating a data breach at a contractor that seems to do an awful lot of business with an awful bunch of sensitive U.S. government agencies. Hooray!
Yes, apparently on a forum somewhere in Russia, someone was auctioning off access to an organization, you know, based on the fact that they did a whole bunch of work for a number of American government agencies. They were asking quite a reasonable price. I think it was $60,000 was the opening bid if you'd like to gain access, you know, to a whole bunch of American agencies. Needless to say, some people noticed and it got tracked down to which particular contractor it was, this company called Miracle Systems, which doesn't sound at all spooky. But yeah, apparently they got themselves good and owned, and the Secret Service are on site investigating, according to Krebs.
And look, as I mentioned a few stories ago, there is another vulnerability, serious one, in Exim. It's like the year of Exim bugs, man. Wow.
Yeah, I guess it hasn't had a whole bunch of attention, but yeah, Exim is, you know, a very widely used mail transport agent on a bunch of Linux systems. And yeah, in this case, there was a bug in the TLS handling. You know, fortunately, not that many people turn on TLS from mail, which
so,
you know,
yeah,
is
another,
terrible in a
it's
way.
Another one of those good news stories, question mark. Yeah.
But the mitigation is you can turn off TLS on your mail, which was always opportunistic and garbage anyway. But I really thought that one of the worst pieces of advice I've seen in ages was maybe don't mitigate this bug using that technique in the EU, because you'll fall foul of GDPR for not encrypting your mail on the wire. So you should stay remotely rootable instead. Worst advice ever.
Isn't it just ridiculous?
It is. It's 100% ridiculous.
It's like, you know, you used to hear about people who do pen tests or, you know, security assessments on site and then say, oh, you know, this entire wireless network has no logging. And they'd say, yeah, good. We don't want to have to respond to anything coming out of there, you know?
Yeah, like, don't look. Don't
that's
look.
An actual thing. That's an yeah, actual
it,
thing.
It really is.
Well, mate, that is it for this week's news. Thanks a lot for joining us. It's fun to have you back, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Yeah, thanks very much, Pat. I'll talk to you then.
That was Insomnia Security's Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news headlines. And yeah, if you're looking for some high-quality app testing or red teaming, do check out Insomnia Security. They are based in New Zealand. They have around 30 consultants, and they really do know what they're doing. And they do service clients all over the world. The New Zealand to US dollar exchange rate is ridiculously favorable to Americans right now, too, in case that is a factor for you. So yeah, get in touch with Insomnia before Trump puts a tariff on Kiwi pen testers. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Steve Barnes and Josh Lamos of BlackBerry Silence. Josh is a VP of research there, and Steve is a senior principal threat researcher. And the last few times we've had Silence people on the show, we've talked a lot about machine learning and, you know, Silence products and things like that. But this time, we got to talk about a more researchy topic, specifically Cyber Command dropping some sweet samples on VirusTotal. Now, funnily enough, I recorded this interview a couple of days before the latest Cyber Command VirusTotal drop. So yeah, it just happened to coincidentally line up nicely. But in this case, I spoke to Josh and Steve about an earlier drop from May, some APT28 malware that they happened to pay attention to. And it turns out APT28 is like, you know, a case study crew for a lot of analysts out there. So drops like the one back in May tend to attract a lot of attention in that community. I spoke to Josh and Steve about this and started off by asking Steve Barnes if there was anything particularly interesting about the malware disclosed by Cybercom back in May, and here's what he had to say.
You know, honestly, once he, you know, kind of dug into it and pulled away the covers, it wasn't anything novel. There was nothing new, you know, that it was doing. It was, you know, for all intents and purposes, it's a backdoor, it's not modular, it uses, you know, conventional C2 tactics to talk to its command and control. The functions that it offers are pretty, you know, run-of-the-mill backdoor tools that you'd expect it to be able to do. And the format, you know, is a statically linked DLL. So, you know, again, it's nothing that's kind of pushing the boundaries or, you know, or the envelope in terms of how it operates or what it does.
So the most interesting thing about it was who created it, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think when we kind of looked at what people were saying, you know, what this was, a, you know, primarily, and who had authored it, you know, then to sort of take a look at it and go, well, based on my understanding of what Xtunnel is supposed to be able to do, I'm not really seeing any of that here. So, you know, therefore, you know, first question is, so what is this? So then obviously you start digging a bit deeper and you start building up a picture and you see that, okay, well, you know, this is now, this is a backdoor which has the following functions. So, okay, that's the picture that we've got. And then, you know, the second perhaps bigger question, which is harder to answer, which is this really APT 28? So, you know, keeping scope to a single sample, you can say this is not necessarily Xtunnel, or at least maybe not yet it's not Xtunnel. But, you know, to say, is this APT 28? We don't know. We can't really say yes or no, you know, on that question.
Isn't it funny, though, that just as human beings, we're so curious about that, right? Because from Silence's point of view, it doesn't matter, right? Like, you just throw it into your models, right? No problem. It's done, you know. But there is that drive to know, isn't there? Like, you just want to.
Yeah, I mean, it helps to put a face, you know, I guess, on the attacker. It's nice. The attribution element is always nice, you know, to understand, I guess, from a higher level, higher perspective, like, what are the motives here? Like, if you can say, okay, this is APT-28, then it's, you know, likely to show up in NATO-aligned countries. You know, what will be the TTPs? What are what's the incentives? What are the motives? What are they likely to be interested in? You know, perhaps it fills in a picture, you know, within the kill chain to say, well, if this is APT-28 and we're finding this sample somewhere, then really we should be looking for perhaps spear phishing emails so that we can say this is how it got in. So it helps to build the picture up, I guess.
Yeah, no, I mean, I guess there are practical considerations. I mean, Steve, you know, as someone who does this stuff for a living, you must be quite enjoying Cyber Command's new tactic of like doxing APT crews. I mean, we love it. We get to report on it. It's hilarious. But yeah, what's that been like for you? Because I think it's taken a lot of people by surprise just seeing this new tactic emerge.
Yeah, because I think, you know, conventionally as a threat researcher, unless you are working for, say, I would guess, you know, perhaps a defense contractor or, you know, somewhere where you're in an environment where you would get to see this type of malware, you know, you wouldn't always necessarily get, you know, the opportunity to have a look at it, to analyze it, to understand it. So, you know, when these samples drop, it's always quite nice to say, okay, this is what, you know, APT malware looks like. This is how they operate. You know, this is, you know, it's just a useful learning exercise as well, you know, to get a look and to understand how it works.
One of the things I really appreciate about this new tactic is because VirusTotal is just linked into the ecosystem so deeply, it's different to like pumping out, you know, a bunch of file hashes, right? Because that's the sort of thing we've seen in the past. Like people would do a write-up, here are the hashes, right? And then, you know, people maybe start playing around with them. But, you know, once something goes into VT, that's it. Like it's going to start throwing red flags. If it's known malicious, if Cyber Command says it's bad, you know certainly there's a signature for it immediately, right? That propagates throughout the world. And then, you know, this APT crew all of a sudden has some burned ops on its hand. I mean, that's going to change. I mean, do you think that'll change the risk calculus on the attacker side and they might not, say, distribute certain key bits of malware as widely because they're worried that they won't be able to decommission it all in case it winds up on VT? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly something you're going to have to factor in, I would assume. I mean, I'm not a red teamer or, you know, working for a nation state on you know, the offensive side, but...
No,
you
know, no moonlighting, no?
Sorry, no moonlighting. but I think you definitely have to be considering it. And I think, you know, any offensive team worth their salt will have factored that into their processes to say, you know, if we get blown, if this is, you know, going to be uncovered, if these tools are going to be thrown up on VT. And I would assume any sensible team would be having markers up there to know when their tools get picked up. You know, if they're serious about their tradecraft, they would have hooks into the environment. Perhaps their own Yara signatures would be there and they would know, you know, if they get a hit, it would be a very good, you know, early marker to say, you know, this is our cover's blown, our ops been, you know, we've been
that's,
discovered.
That's so risky, man, because like you can imagine if someone finds those Yara rules, you know, I mean, that's you know,
as a company, you know, just signing up for a subscription to VirusTotal, you know, you just got a bunch of threat researchers. We just upload signatures. We just, you know, looking for samples. But at the same time, we happen to have these things in place that give us an early mark, you know, an early warning to let us know if things go pear-shaped.
Also with us is Josh Lamos. Josh, I wanted to ask you this question, which is, I sort of wonder what will happen. This is all well and good, right? We're all having fun watching Cyber Command, you know, drop stuff on VirusTotal. But I do wonder what will happen if this whole thing is reversed. And like, it's all fun and games now until, you know, some Workaday Five Eyes tools get burned somehow.
But what I suspect we'll see is that some of these first stage kind of low level spray and pray tools, or, you know, broadly deployed toolkits, will be very commoditized kind of, tool chains, or even, you know, commercial pen testing tools being used as sort of the first stage, and saving the sexier, more sophisticated stuff for very targeted ops where your chance of getting burned is a lot lower.
That's a really interesting thought. So you think they're going to roll like red teams and try to use as much commercial stuff as possible? I mean, that makes sense, right? Because you're avoiding attribution, you're avoiding getting doxxed like this. It kind of requires a big reason APT crews use this type of tooling, right, is it assists automation and you can use lower skilled operators, right?
Sure. But this was, you know, statically linked. It wasn't modular. It wasn't built by, the most sophisticated crews we've seen. And the first thing we're going to do when this stuff gets burned is see what else was that in that environment and start to correlate. Like, is this tool chain or is this, you know, particular sample?
When we find this in an organization, what else do we also find, right? Yeah.
So those associative elements are important to us as threat researchers and give us insight into sort of other TTPs out there.
Yeah.
So it is becoming a game where at first it was Wild West and crews could operate with impunity. Now that we're getting better at detecting it, we have the assistance of kind of the herd immunity approach that CyberComm is taking here. It's making the game more interesting for everyone.
So it sounds like Silence is definitely on board with this new way of doing things.
Oh, we love it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, one thing they did more recently was a bunch of North Korean tools, but it wasn't their malware. It was all their boring back end stuff, right? Like just really boring little tools that they would use to, I don't know, dump creds or pipe connections or whatever the hell it was, right? But it was the boring stuff that now they're going to have to re-engineer. I mean, this whole thing is just calculated to increase cost to attackers.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a very interesting way of protecting kind of US interests or really just making sort of the broader world community more secure.
So Stephen, just cutting back to you for a second, I understand that this was the first one that you really paid attention to. This was the first like Cyber Command dump that really piqued your interest. Why was that? Why was what was it about this one in particular that made you jump in and go,
I think, you know, APT 28, as I've been a malware researcher, I've had a few years now, and the APT28 stuff has always been quite interesting. I in my own personal way, I kind of think it's what any malware researcher looking at APT stuff sort of cuts their teeth on. It's fairly easy to get into.
APT28 is like the case study.
Yeah, it is.
At
least from the samples that I've looked at previously, it was. The bar wasn't set too high. It wasn't, virtualization or any kind of, heavy duty sort of techniques to make your life difficult as a researcher. So it was
just like medium quality Workaday APT malware. Yeah. Journeyman APT crew.
Yeah, that's right. And it's something you can pick up and get your teeth into and build a picture from. So, whenever they drop, it's always kind of nice to sort of have a look at another tool and, see what's going on from them. So yeah, that was the reason when this one dropped, I thought, let's see what they're doing. Let's have a look.
So you're more of an APT 28 watcher than a watching every Cyber Command release watcher.
Yeah, well, saying that, they have dropped, I believe, some North Korean stuff now that I've started to have a look at and just to see what that's doing as well. So
that stuff was interesting because as I was just saying earlier, it's all the boring back end stuff, right? Like, and it's the sort of stuff that it's the boring part of the attack chain, right? But if that stuff gets blown, you still have to re-engineer it, and it's worked.
Yeah, that's right. Still going to deal a blow to them if that gets outed. I think the tool that I was looking at was the SSL proxy tool. So yeah, I don't know where that fits in the picture yet, but you know, it's interesting to look at all the same.
All right, well, Stephen Barnes and Josh Lemos, thank you very much for joining us on Risky Biz to talk through that May release from Cyber Command. It's really great to get a perspective from people who actually work with this stuff on what it all means, on what it all means. Thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks, mate. Always a pleasure.
Thanks, Patrick.
That was Josh Lemos and Steve Barnes from BlackBerry Silence there. Big thanks to them for that. And big thanks to Silence for its support of the Risky Business Podcast over the last few years. And that is it from me this week. I'll be back next week with more security news and analysis. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.